Hard-pressed to tell what it was that gave them the most pleasure, Billy himself expending all this charm on just the two of them, or their own satisfaction that one of them had managed to procure this entertainment for the other. You would be hard-pressed to tell, watching Billy at the head of the table, before his little family, talking and talking, making them laugh, the disappointment that lingered at his heart's core. Disappointment and disbelief. Disbelief that the faith he had sworn to an unrealized future should be so simply, so easily betrayed. She looked into my heart one day and saw your image was there. She has gone weeping away. Then there would be the 10 o'clock walk, the old man slipping a can or two into the kangaroo pockets of his coat, Billy going along for the fresh air, and then, as the old man's legs gave out, going by himself, a cold beer can cupped behind his hand. Walking through the neighborhood together, Billy and his father-in-law would have had little interest stirred by the lights in other living room windows or the sound of other voices, shouts of an argument, the sobbing of a child, since all their talk ended up being about the past, about a time in the old man's life when he was a robust and red-headed young cop, the father of two little girls, when the city was what it used to be, and the woman who made his life what it was still walked the earth. Billy adding his own recollections of what had once been but was no more. Billy sympathizing and telling him so. Her father's physical decline, the slowing circulation, the water retention, the falls with their attendant concussions and sprains, the collapsed lung, the seeping capillaries, would have provided Maeve with enough to occupy her mind, consulting doctors now as she had once gone to the nuns, who went to the priest, getting the doctors, as the priest had done, to warn and reprimand him. Red-headed and fair-skinned, Maeve's father wore his dissipation boldly, blatantly, the same way my father now said to Dan Lynch, he wore his heart on his sleeve. But Billy called him Mr. Kehoe and took on the task of getting him up the stairs at night and into his bed. Maeve would be listening from their own bedroom with its blessed mother colors and the stiff-limbed baby doll that was either a stubborn hanging on to childishness or a balm for her inability to bear a child, a reassuring glance at the past, or compensation for what had not been provided by the future. On the dresser before her, the wedding photo taken only minutes after they had made their vows. This will not change. Listening still as Billy made his way back downstairs again to pour himself another drink and lift the phone from the wall, or, Maeve still listening, lift his car keys and head out the door. The drinking, down at Quinlan's, on his walks with her father, downstairs in the kitchen after she had gone to bed, would have been for her as much a part of Billy's personality as his slow smile, his multitude of cousins and friends, the letters and postcards that seemed to appear beneath his hand, to flow from his fingertips in a nearly unbidden act of prestidigitation. It was just Billy's way, this need to keep in touch, to keep talking, to be called by name when he entered the crowded barroom, slapped on the back, "Glad to see you, have a seat." The drink, a warmth across the cheeks, a watery veil that only brought into relief the gleam on the bar, the light in the mirror, the sparkle of a bottle, silver-topped, amber-filled, as it was plucked from its spot among the rows and rows of bright silver-topped bottles, and poured out again. The telltale aftertaste in the back of his throat, that could only mean the one drink would have to be followed by another, as the talk and the laughter turned, spiraled, not into the heart of his loneliness. He would not mention her now that he was a married man, he was that loyal, but toward the world where that loneliness existed, the world where change and cruelty, separation and loss, pity and sorrow refused to be forgotten or forgiven, the world seen as it should be seen, through a veil of tears, where Uncle Daniel's life could be examined, or Bridie's troubles, his mother's loneliness and his father-in-law's grief, where the passing of time, the cruelty of war, the failure of hope, the death of the young could be discussed and examined. A young president over the years, the young sons of cousins and of neighbors and friends, young children right over here in Kew Gardens, taken from their beds. A world where love, more difficult still, could be spoken of by a hand on the shoulder, a fresh drink placed on the bar, good to see you, through welling tears, real ones now. Ah, Billy, it's always good to see you. dark, sparkling, sprinkled with moments when the sound and smell and sight of the place, the taste at the back of his throat, transported him, however briefly, to a summer night long ago, when he was young and life was all promise and she was there to turn to drink in. This was also the world where his faith met him, became actual, no longer as mere promise or possibility, but as inevitable and true. No less than the cathedrals and churches and synagogues scattered throughout the city that had once sustained and amazed him. Now the various bars he stopped into, for lunch, after work, between calls for Con Ed, and most evenings as the day came to a close, reminded him that what he sought, what he longed for, was universal and constant. Quinlan's was the best of them, sure, but each bar he went into offered the same familiar light and scent, the same company, the same talk. And in each of them, the force of his faith, of his church, a force he could only glimpse briefly while sober, maybe for a second or two after communion when he knelt and bowed his head, or for that brief instant when he pushed aside the heavy curtain and stepped into the dark confessional, or in the first rising scent of the incense at benediction, became clear and steady and as fully true as the vivid past or the as yet unseen but inevitable future. A true redemption. It was a favorite word of his after a few. Dan Lynch and my father agreed, a favorite topic. A redemption that was not merely a pretty story grown up around a good man, but a fact that changed the very fiber of the day, the moment. Drunk, when Billy turned his eyes to heaven, heaven was there. Dan Lynch himself had seen it in Billy's eyes, he said again, years before, August 15th, Feast of the Assumption, when they'd hightailed it over to Mass. Heaven was there, utterly necessary, utterly sensible, the only possible reconciliation of the way he must live day by day, and the certainty he'd felt that life meant something greater. The only redemption, the only compensation for the disappointment, the cruelty and pain that plagued the living, for love itself. Because when he turned his eyes to heaven, heaven was there, and Eva was in it. Waiting up for him, Maeve would say a rosary and think of the Bing Crosby song, counting her blessings instead of sheep. Money was no problem, and the house and yard more than she'd ever dreamed of. He never missed a day of work at either job, and even in his cups never raised a hand toward her. Not for years, anyway. Hardly raised his voice, and never failed to give her his arm when they went out. He was kind to her father. He was a handsome man. And although the hour might be late, and he might not make it up the stairs on his own, although she might have to call Dennis to help her get him in from the lawn or up off the floor, still, he came home every night, eventually, managing always, it might have been planned, to stay conscious until he had at least stopped the car somewhere near the driveway or the curb. She could manage his legs if Dennis could just get him under the arms. She could place herself between his knees, her elbows locked beneath his calves, her hips bearing whatever weight she could not bear on her forearms, and maneuver him up the stairs, the landing the trickiest part, the little round table with the Hummel children being upset more than once, my father muttering on his way back down again, "Couldn't you find another spot for that, Maeve?" Telling my mother the next morning, reminding Dan Lynch now of her damn figurines. She would be breathless by the time she got him to the bed, the backs of her legs black and blue from where his heels might have caught her, her arms weary, rubbed pink by the rough gabardine of his pant legs. Together they would undress him as well as they could, Maeve being the more adept, having cared so long for her old father. Dennis suspecting sometimes that Billy's determined unconsciousness was willful, even planned, a door he had sought and had stepped through and pulled closed behind him. His body remained thin, the same long, thin legs and hairless chest, the same pale skin, chalk white except for the raw patches of psoriasis and the nearly theatrically ruddy cheeks, so he looked for all the world in that moment before Maeve pulled the sheet up over him like some broken martyr, a tortured and heaven-bound saint. Billy Lynch in the flesh, in her own home. Calmly, she would go downstairs and put the kettle on. A little sliver of cake with that, Dennis? Dennis sitting down with her in the tiny kitchen at all hours of the night to give her some company, to discuss a cure, AA, a drying out hospital, a pill he'd read about that makes it impossible to hold down a drink, to let the hot liquid soothe the grief in his throat that told him that Billy, just like her old father, was determined to die on them. And that Maeve was determined to hang on to any kind of life at all, as long as Billy was in it. The appearance of sobriety alone, good enough. Good enough. From the very beginning, Dan Lynch went on, Billy didn't buy the AA bit, even for the old man. He didn't buy this getting up and admitting that each and every one of them, every drunk, is exactly the same. He didn't buy this trying to freeze people out in order to make them quit, either. Billy's got to hit rock bottom before he'll quit, Ted Lynch told me. He shook his head. Jesus, he said softly. Nice sentiment. But look what Billy did. Billy sat with the old man and poured him his drinks and listened to his tale of woe because he knew that's what the old man needed. He sympathized. Dan paused, squinted into his drink. I only wish we'd had sense enough to do the same for Billy, he said. Maybe then he wouldn't have died out on the street the way he did. My father said, he didn't die on the street. He died in the hospital. Found on the street, then, Dan Lynch said. But it was clear that in his every telling of it in the future, it would remain died in the street. Found on the street like some bum instead of dying in his bed like Maeve's father did, because Billy had the sense to feed him his whiskey at home and let him talk. Dan looked into his drink. I tell you, Dennis, I've got some guilt about it all tonight. I think we should have done the same for Billy. Never mind this trying to trick him into staying sober, forcing him into it. You telling him he couldn't come over to the house to see the kids, and me convincing Quinlan not to serve him? Jesus, there was a humiliation for the poor guy. And then Ted sicking his AA buddies on him like stormtroopers. There's no drunk like a reformed drunk, Billy said. He made a joke out of it, sure, but they drove him crazy, puffing away on their cigarettes and glassy-eyed from all the coffee they guzzled at those meetings. They hounded him. And then Father Jim, who had a problem himself, you know, dragging him over to Ireland, his sisters wagging their fingers at him, the two husbands, too, although you can't tell me Peter Sullivan isn't in the same boat. And Maeve and her novenas. What were we thinking? He looked up at my father. We should have sat him here, he pointed to the empty space of couch beside him, and fed him his whiskey and let him talk. There was a pain in him that only alcohol eased. Who were we to tell him to give up the drink and live with the pain? My father held out his hand, palm up, a gesture that for me recalled and encompassed my life's entire experience of him, a plea for reasonableness. That's not what we told him, Dan, he said. Essentially it is, Dan Lynch answered, stubborn. It's not, my father said. He might have lived another 20 years if we'd gotten him to quit. He might not have wanted to, Dan Lynch said. They were silent again, each one looking into opposite corners of the room, once more weighing words. I sensed that they both understood that this was not an argument either of them was up to pursuing, or for that matter, winning. Dan Lynch would not want to prove, finally, that they should have stood by ready to pour while Billy drank himself to death. My father would not want to hear Dan Lynch concede that Billy, their Billy with his letters and his jokes, his loyalty and his broken heart, could have been cured of his affliction by rote, set back into his life by the simple application of some formula meant for everyone else. I moved the ice around in Billy's drink. Give the man that much credit. Dan Lynch said, you know, Billy never mentioned her again after he married Maeve. He lifted an eyebrow. At least not to me, he added. And all the nights we met and had a drink or two together, you know, before things got bad with him, you never heard him say a word about that girl, despite all he'd said about her before he met Maeve. But my father sipped his drink, admitted nothing. Dan Lynch sat back abruptly. His sisters asked me today, did Maeve know anything about her, the Irish girl? I told them I couldn't say. He seemed a little sheepish, as if he were reluctant to part with his authority. He, after all, had been the best man. I said she must have known something. My father shrugged. Her old man had told her something. Billy had told him early on. Much? Dan asked, one smooth eyebrow still raised. With his bald head cocked and the stubby glass in his fist, he looked like a cartoon prizefighter. As much as there was to know, I suppose, my father said. She can't have liked it. My father smiled. Claire was engaged once too, remember? To one of those fellas who might not have come home if we hadn't dropped the bomb. I can't say it ever bothered either of us. But Billy didn't give up the girl. She was taken from him, Dan said. That would make a big difference to a woman. My father shrugged, lifted his drink. I wondered for a moment if he would say Eva never died. Turn up the lights in Dan Lynch's little place and let the irony flood the room. It was only a lie. If you're looking for sense, Dan, you're not going to find it here. But what he said was, We're talking ancient history, Danny. Billy gave Maeve enough to think about day after day. She wouldn't have to go back that far to find something to fret over. They were silent again, their glasses nearly empty. I drank from mine and listened to the rain, to a distant siren somewhere, to a few shouted words from down in the street, Spanish, Farsi. The two men looked into their drinks, ignoring it all, concentrating, it seemed to me, concentrating on conjuring something that they both understood would be fleeting, momentary, something that would be glimpsed only briefly if they managed to glimpse it at all. A way to make sense, or else a way to tell the story that would make them believe it was sensible. Were they happy? Dan said finally. Billy and Maeve, do you think? Were they ever close? He would not look either of us in the eye, as if the question had embarrassed him. She put up with him, my father said, knowing it wasn't an answer. She chose to, Dan Lynch said. Now he raised his head. She chose him, and as far as I can see, he fit her to a T, her old man all over again. Someone to maneuver, to shore up. An alcoholic with a shadow across his heart. An alcoholic because he had a shadow across his heart, the way I see it. He shook his head, squinting into the dim room. I don't begrudge her tears, of course, but I wonder, too. Would she have known what to do with a sober man, with the full force of the affection of a sober man who'd never loved another? Now it was my father's turn to lower his eyes. Who can say? He asked. I don't think so, Dan Lynch said, sitting back, a definitive nod. I don't think she would have known, Dennis. I don't think Billy just is himself without the girl there first, this Eva. I don't think Maeve would have found him so easy to maneuver. He'd had half the life taken out of him when that girl died, and that could well have been just the thing that made him right for Maeve. Sure, he said. He raised his hand from his thigh and then placed it back down again. Sure, she put up with him all these years, but in other ways, Billy asked very little of her. I'm certain he asked very little of her. He glanced quickly at me, trying to recall, it seemed, whether I was 28 or 12. There were no children, he said. He nearly whispered it, as if the fact had been a secret. And Billy loved children. My father shook his head impatiently. He seemed annoyed. It might have been his natural disinclination to wholeheartedly agree with Dan Lynch about anything. It might have been his reluctance to consider the possibility that the lie he'd told Billy all those years ago was not merely the cause of 30 years of pointless grief, but the very thing that had made Billy's life with Maeve possible and fruitless. Billy wanted too much, my father said finally. He leaned to put his glass on the coffee table, on top of the St. Anthony Messenger. It was both a way to dismiss the conversation and to show he was ready to take his leave. He had some strange thoughts about the world, Danny, you know he did. About the way the world should be. You wouldn't have tolerated it in most other people. You would have said, "Ah, come on now." He stood. I stood too, Billy's drink still in my hand. My father's voice said he was at the end of his patience. His voice said, "Let's get to the bottom of things." Maeve made the same mistake we all did, Dan. She not only put up with him, she hoped he was right in all his strange notions. She hoped the world would somehow turn out to be just the way he believed it to be. She hoped somehow that he'd turn out to be right in the end with all his hanging on to the past, all his loyalty to the dead, even if it meant she'd have no life of her own. He swatted the air. Billy didn't need someone to pour him his drinks. He needed someone to tell him that living isn't poetry. It isn't prayer. To tell him and convince him. And none of us could do it, Danny, because every one of us thought that as long as Billy believed it was, as long as he kept himself believing it, then maybe it could still be true. Jesus Christ, Danny, he said, and then stopped. In the silence that followed, I fully expected him to say it was a lie. It was a lie, and Billy knew it. Dan Lynch sat in his seat, the empty glass on his Tattersall knee, his piles of books and magazines, his mother's own pieces. He looked at my father, his mouth closed, his eyes surprised and maybe a little hurt, but forgiving him already for this outburst because, you know, he would tell them down at Quinlan's, it was hard on Dennis, having to identify Billy and all. It had been a hard week all around. My father would not tell Dan Lynch the truth. I knew simply by looking from one to the other that he would never tell Dan Lynch the truth. It was, after all, yet another sweet romance to preserve. Jesus Christ, my father said again, but softly now, that old fading annoyance on his face. Sometimes the less said the better, do you know what I mean? Dan nodded, clearly disappointed to have the conversation pulled out from under him like this. I had the sense that he'd have liked to talk all night, but forgiving my father already. Sure, he said. Let's put it to rest for tonight. Billy's ears must be burning. My father smiled. Gone but not forgotten, he said. He left the Flushing office at mid-morning, driving in the rain to the VA hospital, where the girl at the information desk had said, "You're welcome, officer," after she'd given him directions to the morgue. "Have a nice day, detective," she'd called out when he left, the ordeal at long last over. She was smiling, he said, but with an edge to it. A young woman, Hispanic of some sort, no doubt with a boyfriend on Rikers Island. That morning, Maeve's neighborhood was sodden with the rain, the shingles and roofs a shade darker, surely, than they would have been in dry weather. Silver puddles in every pothole, a small river flowing along the crumbling curb. There were cardboard bunny rabbits and Easter eggs hung in storm windows here and there, marking the homes where children lived or visited. Dorothy, the neighbor lady, was already over. Maeve was on the phone, and one of Billy's white shirts was already washed out and on a hanger, dripping dry into the kitchen sink. The undertaker's number was already written out, and the number for the rectory. She'd had nights enough, he supposed, to rehearse her every step should the worst occur, so that now that it had finally happened, it was all, for Maeve, part of an old routine. She knew, Dorothy whispered, as if knowing, in Billy's case, required any prescience. Sitting at her kitchen table, Dennis devised a list, writing on the back of an empty windowed envelope, of the friends and relations he would call himself, and then copied it over again so Maeve would know they'd been taken care of. He called Kate and Rosemary from the phone in the kitchen, and half a dozen Lynch cousins. He brought Billy's best blue suit to the dry cleaners on the corner. And then there seemed for the moment nothing else for him to do but to go back to work. It was shock that Billy had actually died of, not the cirrhosis, although the cirrhosis was certainly far advanced. Shock, as Dennis understood it, from his stomach being filled up with blood. He'd been found collapsed on the street in Flushing, just off Main Street, leaving some two-bit gin mill with his car keys in his hand, still in his hand when they found him, although his wallet was gone. It was a patrol car that found him, removing officer, not dead yet, but dying. Dead 3 hours after they got him to the emergency room, one of the nurses there finally recognizing him and able to give him a name. Not Billy, Dennis's first thought when he saw him. A colored man, thank God. When he left Maeve's, he took a minute to swing by Bridie's. It wasn't much out of the way. Standing at the top of her narrow stoop, he saw the curtain that covered the door glass move and had to shout through the wood. Bridie was out at the grocery store. It was the lady who sometimes took care of Jim, and she had strict instructions not to let anybody in. He said that she should tell Bridie he'd call her later. He would not stand there in the rain shouting the news. But of course, by the time he called her, Bridie was able to say,
"Oh, Dennis, I heard. I called Maeve. I had a feeling that was why you'd stopped by."
When in truth he had stopped by mostly to see the shock on Bridie's face when he told her Billy was gone, the disbelief. Standing over Billy in that cold room, and soon enough the fat colored man they had shown him was transformed by the familiar curve of his hairline, the shape of an ear, the smooth lips, into Billy himself. He had felt his hands form into fists and had turned to the young attendant to say furiously, "Isn't this a damnable thing?" But how could the poor man respond? No doubt he saw such things every day. The husks of every kind of life carted out and carted away. Details like who he was, how he died, how the dusting of psoriasis on his bare leg recalled a bit of sea salt that had been there once long ago. Irrelevant now, barely interesting. What could the poor man say? Dennis had gone to Bridie's house in the hope of seeing in Bridie's eyes the acknowledgement, the shock, untempered by any premonition, that this was Billy they were talking about, Billy who had collapsed on the street. You could see the mark of the sidewalk on his dark cheek, one of those freckled bruises Dennis had last seen on his children's knees. Billy, whose life had ended this way. Billy Lynch. Guggenheimer. Our Billy who had left us in this terrible and willful way. Dennis had a call to make in St. Albans, a Baptist church with a string of adjectives before its name. First Ethiopian, Pentecostal, Afro-Asian, whatever, whatever. So much exclusivity that you might expect the door of the chapel to be no bigger than a needle's eye. The pastor was the intellectual sort, a tall and handsome black man in his early 30s. Full of himself and his calling, his eyes always falling on a spot 3 or 4 inches above Dennis's head, his own head always drawn back a bit as he spoke, as if racism were a scent Dennis gave off. As if it never occurred to the man that most of Dennis's customers these days, for years now, since he'd left Irving Place for the office in Queens, were colored. And Dennis, to tell the truth, busy recalling all the while they spoke one of Billy's stories, about walking down a street in New York with his mother's sister, who was just off the boat, and a colored man passing them by, and then minutes later, another, who was walking briskly. Billy's aunt had looked over her shoulder at the second man as he went by, and then leaned to Billy, a boy then, and said,
"He'll have to walk faster than that if he's going to catch up with his friend."
The pastor wanted to run a new separate line in for the nursery school and up the amperage in the sacristy. Did they call it that? And choir loft, for a new sound system and music synthesizer. There was no urgency for the first, but the second, optimally, should be completed by the beginning of May, which was an anniversary of some sort. Dennis said his usual, "The best we can," and dropped another reverend into the conversation to show that he respected the man and his diplomas and his good work, despite the fact that he himself was white and authentically Christian, i.e. Roman Catholic, and old enough to be this particular reverend's father. He was surprised when the man walked him all the way to the door of the little church, thinking that perhaps he had, with his calculated deference, won him over. The rain was still coming down in sheets, the gray day still the one in which Billy Lynch had died. Dennis put on his hat and turned to shake the minister's hand, and instantly felt the corner of a neatly folded bill prick his palm.
"First week of May," the reverend said. "It's really a must."
Now, finally, he brought his dark eyes down to Dennis's. He smiled,
but not kindly, more as if you can picture it, he had looked into Dennis's shallow soul, had heard every damn nigger he had ever breathed, over the newspaper, at the wheel of his car, as if he knew the narrow, ordinary, and ineffectual course of his life, of Billy's life, of the life of everyone like him. The superior smile of someone ennobled by true suffering, justifiable rage, someone whose pain amounted to something, whose love saved lives. Dennis nodded. He found himself searching for a joke to make, as if a joke might prove he was more than the sum of the things the man was sure he knew about him. "Dig we must," he said, but the SOB had already turned away. Standing on the sidewalk beside his car, Dennis unfolded the bill. A 10. "There you go, Billy." And then dropped it on the sidewalk for some kid to find. "Here's the thing," he said. We were on our way home in the dark in the now steady heavy rain. Back in the 60s, when it was still dig we must, when it looked for certain that he'd be promoted to manager, a nearly 20-year-old letter was produced from his personnel file. A letter from a Mr. Jacob R. Leibowitz, Jake, from whom by then he had bought 4 layette sets and maybe 20 pairs of footed pajamas, good wool Sunday coats, and at least a half dozen birthday blouses for your mother. The letter said that 3 weeks ago money was exchanged between him and a certain young man in your employ, a certain Mr. Lynch, with the understanding that as a result of said payment, service would be provided in a timely manner, and yet service had only this morning been restored. Dennis supposed he hadn't been called up on the carpet for it back then because he had plenty of friends and personnel in those days. Mary Casey was there, and his cousin Mal, Uncle Jim's son. But with the possibility of the promotion, the powers that be took a second look and found the letter that Jake had written in 1946 and so passed him over. "We're passing you over this time," they said, apologizing, but there was little doubt in his mind then that it was for good. That evening he took the subway home as usual, picked up the car as usual at Lefferts Boulevard, and drove the rest of the way to Rosedale. The kids were crowded into the kitchen as usual, their mother at the stove frying fish, the dog underfoot. Homework and baths and prayers, not to mention the back of his hand to one or the other of them, and then the evening paper and a smoke before he's winding the clock again. Claire said, "Oh, don't let it bother you," but there was the extra money as well as the boost it might have given his ego, and there were 4 college tuitions to think of. Not to mention the mark the letter left on his good name, his honesty, and the taint it might give to his friendship with Jake, whom you really couldn't blame in the long run because he had written the letter when Dennis was a stranger to him, and the bitter taste of all he'd been through in the war was still on his tongue. "How much was it?" Claire asked.
$10, Dennis said.
"Cheapskate," Claire said, making a joke of it. "He could have given you 20. And then the phone ringing into his dreams at 2, 3 a.m., that god-awful hour, Claire not even bothering to open her eyes for it. He stumbled out into the hallway where the phone was, the only light coming from the dim lamps left burning all night in the children's 2 rooms. Billy's thick voice, in mid-sentence, it seemed, no doubt because Dennis himself had not yet come fully awake in order to catch the first few words, but giving him then, at 2 or 3 a.m. in the darkness, the impression that his cousin had been talking all along, all through the day and night, his steady stream of words and undercurrent to every moment of their existence. "He was thinking," Billy said, "about the life she didn't have, of all that had been denied her." Dennis listened first for some sound in the background, some indication of where he was calling from. There was only silence. Nights in a husband's arms, children, the movement of the seasons, the changes, melancholy or not, that came with age, with having a good span of years to look back on. "Where are you, Billy?" Dennis said. Billy said he was thinking about what a brief life it had been. The brevity of it couldn't have struck them then, they were young enough themselves,
But now, as they themselves grew older, didn't it become clear that it was only a handful of years that she'd been given, only a blink to call her lifetime? Wasn't it something that as they themselves grew older, the cruelty of it, the unfairness, became more pronounced, more clear?
"Are you at home?" Dennis asked.
Billy said he was, but Dennis was only sure it was true when he heard the dog moving around on the kitchen floor. This one would have been Trixie, scratching her neck and jiggling her collar.
"And where's the old man?" Dennis asked.
"In bed,"
Billy answered impatiently. Out cold was how Dennis thought of it. His own loss of her was one thing, Billy said. He'd long ago stopped thinking of himself in that regard. He'd had life enough himself, hadn't he? Here he was, a married man with a house of his own and two jobs and friends enough. His life had gone on, hadn't it? But he wasn't thinking of himself, you see. Tonight, he was thinking only of her, of all she'd been cheated of.
"Go to bed, Billy," Dennis said.
Tonight the cruelty of it struck him. A girl so young, her childhood behind her, her life, marriage, motherhood, just about to begin. Was she born just to live these brief years and die? Was everything she'd felt and thought so utterly meaningless to her maker? Where was the sense in it? There was no sense in it.
"Close up the bottle now, Billy," Dennis said. "Go upstairs to your wife."
There was a silence. Dennis was familiar enough with these phone calls to know that it could mean Billy had simply put the phone down to reach for another drink, or had passed out, or if he was far enough along, had simply forgotten what it was he was saying. He might even have broken the connection. Dennis waited. He heard the muffled ticking of the clock, saw in the dimness the familiar shape of Claire's hip and shoulder under the dark blanket, felt his children's breath on the warm, close air of the small house in the middle of the night. There was the pull of indigestion in his gut, the same indigestion that had plagued him since early this morning, when he'd been called in and told that a letter had been found in his personnel file, written some time ago, but troubling still.
"We have to rail against it,"
Billy said hoarsely.
"Go to bed, Billy."
"The injustice of it," Billy said. "The way she was cheated."
Dennis heard the sound of Billy's glass hitting the mouthpiece, the heavy swallow. He could almost smell the stuff on his breath.
"We can't be bribed into silence because we've lived long ourselves. We have to remember what she was deprived of."
"I'm not going to stay on the line with you, Bill,"
Dennis said patiently, although he well knew that as soon as he hung up, Billy would be dialing someone else. Danny or Ted or one of his priests, keeping them up to all hours as well.
"We both have to be at work tomorrow, Billy. That's all you need to remember. You're expected at work. You'll be sick as a dog if you don't close up the bottle now and go to bed."
"Death is a terrible thing," Billy said.
"Death comes to us all," Dennis told him, "but 7 a.m. will come sooner."
"Our Lord knew it,"
Billy went on.
"Our Lord knew it was terrible. Why would he have shed his own blood if death wasn't terrible?"
There was another pause, another sip of whiskey.
"You know what makes a mockery of the crucifixion?" Billy said. "You know what makes it pointless? Anyone saying that death is just an ordinary thing, an ordinary part of life. It happens. You reconcile yourself. You go on. Anyone saying that is saying our Lord's coming was to no avail."
Dennis heard the click of the glass again.
"I'm not staying on," he said.
"What do we need the redemption for?" Billy asked him. "If death isn't terrible, if we're reconciled, why do we need heaven or hell? It makes no difference. If death doesn't trouble us, the injustice of it, then we don't need heaven or hell, do we? It might as well be a lie."
If ever Dennis had the chance and the inclination to say, Billy, it was a lie, he had it now. But it was 3 a.m., and the indigestion was scratching at the back of his throat. And there was work tomorrow, when he would have to go back to his usual desk and his usual routine, loud-mouthed Macaulay with the orange crush-colored hair moving on to management, that single spark of small ambition that had ever flared in him extinguished now. Wife, children, house, now the extent of his success.
"That's why I won't go back out to the island," Billy said. His voice had lost some of its fierceness.
Even he, in his cups, knew this was covered territory.
"Jesus," Dennis whispered, to show Billy he knew it too. "I won't be placated by that beauty," Billy said. "I'll do that much for her."
"Go to bed, Billy," Dennis said. There was another silence.
"Is it still the same, Dennis?"
he asked, his voice tinged with nostalgia.
"Holtzman's place, East Hampton, 3 Mile Harbor."
"It's still the same."
"Are you going out there again this summer?"
"Who knows? She's talking about renting it out."
"I won't go there," Billy said. "None of us will if she rents it. I won't see it again.
She thinks it's a waste of money keeping it empty all year, now that Holtzman's gone."
"I'll do that much for her, Dennis. I'll stay away. She never went back and neither will I."
Dennis paused, trying to convey by his silence as best he could the end of his patience.
"Close up the bottle now, Billy," he said softly. "You'll be dead yourself if you keep up this drinking."
He heard more silence in return, another deep swallow, and then,
"Are the children asleep, Dennis?"
"Of course," Dennis said.
"God bless them, they're a handful, aren't they?"
Resigned, wide awake now, Dennis sank into the chair by the old phone table, pulling at the leg of his pajamas as he did, as if he had a crease to preserve. He glanced into his son's room and saw the shadows strewn across the floor, sneakers and clothes, books and toys.
"Some days," he said.
He crossed his bare ankles before him, tucked his free hand under his elbow, settling in.
"No broken bones this week?"
Billy was chuckling.
"Not this week," Dennis said. "God bless them," Billy said again.
And another long pause, another drink taken. Dennis considered telling him a funny little something one of them had said, when Billy began to speak again, his voice growing heavier.
"It's a pact with the devil," he said, "to be reconciled. Our Lord spilling his every drop of blood on the cross to show us death is terrible, a terrible injustice, and all the while we're telling ourselves that it's not so bad after all. You get over it, you get used to it. Life is lovely despite the fact of a young woman dying, her children all unborn. Life's still good. What's beautiful stays beautiful. Life goes on pleasantly enough no matter who dies."
"It does,"
Dennis said wearily, although it struck him on this day, at this hour, that it was, for him, another lie.
"What's that?"
Billy said. He was far into it now.
"I said it does,"
Dennis told him, raising his voice. Claire stirred, pulling the blanket up over her shoulder with a shadowy hand.
"Life goes on, Billy," he said.
Billy whispered,
"I won't let it."
"We don't have much say in the matter,"
Dennis said, but Billy was already off the line. He sat for a few minutes in the dark hallway, a cold draft blowing across his bare feet. He wondered if Maeve would be calling in another hour or two. If he went back to bed, would he go back to sleep? He thought of his father, the first and foremost in those days, of the people he loved who had died. The very thought itself a prayer to the man in heaven, which he had surely earned, if only by dint of the flattery he had poured on God in every detail of his creation for the 60-odd years he had lived. Or, if God required such things, by dint of the terrible pain he'd endured at the end.
even in compensation for the fact that for all the love he'd poured out for friends and family for all the years that he lived, he was never, let's face it, loved sufficiently in return. Not by the one being whose love he most sought, anyway. He thought of his father, as he did so often in those days when his father was first and foremost of those he missed, the very thought of him a prayer of sorts, one that said, "I'm weary, Dad, and discouraged. I've lost all sense of delight." Although, truth be told, it struck him that night, at that lonely hour, that his father in death was no more present to him, no more real, no more vivid, than Eva was to Billy, in her just-over-the-Atlantic afterlife, pumping gas on the convent road in Clonmel. "Who can trace such things?" he said. But it was perhaps the first tremor of the devastation that would strike him, knock him off his feet, in the weeks and months after my mother died. Billy's 30 years of misdirected prayer, Billy's tenacious, life-changing belief, his own lie. For one of my mother's birthdays, my father wrapped a box of 50 matchbooks in bright tissue paper and then inscribed the card, "For a mate who is matchless." It drew a great laugh at the dinner table that night, amid the remains of the sugary, elaborately iced cake, the already opened birthday blouse from Jake's, and served as a catalyst, at least as I recall it, for a discussion about which of them would remarry should anything happen to the other, which I suppose would have to place this particular birthday in a time when anything happening was such a remote possibility that speculation about it was benign and even pleasurable, a kind of flirtation. When a birthday gift of 50 matchbooks and a carton of cigarettes to go with them held no omen. Coyly, my mother devised a list. There was a young widower down the street, and the son of the man who owned the delicatessen she shopped in. A good-looking Italian kid, she said, maybe 25. There was the guy she'd taken driving lessons from when they'd first moved out to Rosedale, married, she thought, but she could still look him up. She could look up Bob O'Brien, her old flame, her old fiancé, the one my father stole her away from while he was still in the Navy, off cleaning up the Pacific. And his brother Ken, who'd had a crush on her all along and never did marry himself, as far as she knew. She could go on, she said, grinning, the cigarette held beside her ear, the thick, sweet icing still on her plate. The possibilities were endless. She still had some of the old charm. "Should I go on?" she said, and my father bowed his head, laughing. "No," he said, "don't go on." "And what would you do?" she asked him. "Look up Irish Mary?" My father shook his head, although we had heard him say often enough when my mother had run up a big bill at Gert's or A&S, or had forgotten to buy dessert, or had dismissed him with a wave of her hand, "I should have married Irish Mary." "There'd be no one else for me," he said seriously. "I couldn't marry again. You could, you should. But there'd be no one else for me." In the arc of an unremarkable life, a life whose triumphs are small and personal, whose trials are ordinary enough, as tempered in their pain as in their resolution of pain, the claim of exclusivity in love requires both a certain kind of courage and a good dose of delusion. Irish Mary, Eva's sister, would have been happy enough to accept my father's ring, I suppose, had Eva not chosen to stay in Ireland and marry Tom. My mother's first fiancé would have married her gladly if he hadn't been kept too long overseas by the Navy, if my father hadn't beaten him home on points a full year before. It might have been Cody or John in the car with your father that day on Long Island. I might have been gone. Those of us who claim exclusivity in love do so with a liar's courage. There are 100 opportunities, thousands over the years, for a sense of falsehood to seep in, for all that we imagine as inevitable to become arbitrary, for our history together to reveal itself as only a matter of chance and happenstance, nothing irrepeatable or irreplaceable, the circumstantial mingling of just one of the so many million with just one more. In the weeks and months after my mother died, my father grew silent about her,
never mentioning her name and drawing his head back just a little every time anyone else did. My brothers and I noticed this about him and, without ever discussing it ourselves, simply let him be. We had all seen his reaction at the graveside when my mother's sister, who read entire books about such things and in church prayed loudly, her eyes closed and her hands raised to the altar, leaned into him and said,
"You can cry, Dennis. Big boys do cry."
He had smiled a little, looking over her head and wearing the pained, polite expression the early Christians might have worn as the Romans lit the kindling at their feet. Without ever discussing it, my brothers and I agreed we would not torture our father with our advice or our concern or with any well-meaning injunctions for him to tell us what he was feeling. We would let him be. He could not talk about her, fine. He could not sit through Mass without her, fine. I was then in my senior year at the Mary Lewis Academy. During my mother's last hospitalization, my father had begun driving me there most mornings, stopping first at the hospital so we could say hello, and then taking me to school before he went on to Con Ed to put in an hour or two, FaceTime, before he went back to the hospital again. He continued to drive me to school after she was gone, a convenience for me, an easy enough detour for him. There was a morning radio show he liked, a father and son team, the father having been in broadcasting since before the war, the son clearly being groomed to take over alone when the time came. They cracked corny jokes and recited odd news items between traffic reports and weather updates and easy listening ballads, and their soft and amicable banter gave us reason enough to say little to each other throughout the ride. When I got out, I would slam the door and then lean down to wave goodbye through the car window. He would give a little salute and then drive on. His profile, in the last second I could catch it, tense and determined, leaning into the day, it seemed to me, heading toward what must be done and who must be attended to now that the passionate attention he had turned so exclusively to my mother in the past year of her dying was over and she was gone. Unable, he told me on the night of Billy's funeral, when we lingered for a few more minutes in the living room of the Rosedale house before he went up to his bed in the room that used to be their own and I went to the one that used to be mine, utterly unable, he said, to convince himself that the attention he had given her in that last year, the closeness they had felt, the assurance that they had achieved something exclusive, something redemptive in the endurance of their love, had been any more than another well-intentioned deception, another construction, as unbelievable, when you came right down to it, as the spontaneity of a love song in some Broadway musical, the supposedly heartfelt supplication of a well-rehearsed hymn, the bearing any one of Billy's poems about life and death and love and misery had on the actual way any of us lived from day to day. He could not convince himself then, he said, in those days and months after her death, that heaven was any more than a well-intentioned deception meant to ease our own sense of foolishness, to ease pain. Despite his own years of vigilant Catholicism, despite his own mother's deathbed conversion, despite the promises he and my mother had exchanged, he could no longer see death as anything other than the void that met a used-up body, a spent mind. Not a mere moment over which you could sail, buoyed by love, by faith, but the abyss toward which you stumbled inevitably, part of the crowd. Put out a hand, if you like, to help someone along. Surround yourself, if you like, with people who love you, who owe you, whose lives you've changed. But don't expect it to make a difference. It will make no difference. Eventually, one after the other, every one of you will fall. "And now?" I asked him, both of us standing, not sitting, aware that there had been enough talking today. "Do you still feel that way now?" Aware, too, that we were edging close to it, to that embarrassing profundity he and Dan had feared, to the point at which too much had been said. But amazed, I suppose much as my father had once been amazed when his mother told him to get Billy to go out there, he's avoided it for too long. Amazed at this kind of conversation, at this stage of the game. A conversation, it occurred to me, that Billy's life had spurred for us, much as it had once spurred it for my father and his dying mother. My father's eyes were a deep brown. He smiled a little, shaking his head. Oh, no, he said. Not now. How lonely they all seemed to me that night, my father's family and friends. Lonely souls, every one of them, despite husbands and children and cousins and friends. All their hopes in the end, their pairings and procreation and their keeping in touch, keeping track. Futile in the end. Failing in the end to keep them from seeing that nothing they felt, in the end, has made any difference.
It was only a brief loss of faith, he said. It happens. They say it's not uncommon.
And then he turned to climb the stairs on the night of the day Billy Lynch was placed in his grave.
I believe everything now, he said, his back to me. Again.
Of course, there was no way of telling if he lied. So Billy rented a car and drove down to see her. The pledge taken, the last drink the one he'd had with Father Ryan on the flight over to Shannon, Father Jim raising the tiny bottle and smacking his lips and telling Billy, "Dear Lord, this isn't the blind leading the blind," setting the tone, so to speak, for their journey, whose seriousness of purpose, Father Jim was saying in his way, did not have to deprive it of its good humor. The car was rented in the priest's name, and the license Billy carried was the priest's as well, since his own had once again been suspended. So it was Father this and Father that at the rent-a-car office, despite the wedding band that he hadn't bothered to remove, couldn't remove if he tried the way his hands were. A married priest, then. Not, as Danny Lynch would say, to make too much of such things. He'd planned, just as Kate suspected, to visit her grave. He foresaw a grassy plot and a granite stone engraved with her name and the dates, the last not merely marking the end of her life, but the end of his youth and that glorious and astounding possibility that he had once inhabited. He foresaw his own pale fingers, which trembled anyway, tracing the carved numbers and words. He thought of Danny Boy. He was in Ireland, after all, and the clouds were low over the fields he was passing. They were casting their shadows on the green and melancholy hills all around him. Even hummed it as he drove. You'll come and find the place where I am lying, and kneel and say an ave there for me. Which in turn brought him thoughts of Uncle Daniel, and of Billy Sheehy's dad singing out all unrehearsed at the side of his grave. A moment that might have killed them all, the pain of it no less than the beauty. In his own prayer, he would say he had not returned to the house on Long Island either, and never would. Such was his sympathy and his outrage, both of them as keen as ever, regardless of the time gone by. But first, he thought, he would go to her family. Mother or father, if they still lived, Mary certainly, or one of the three younger sisters who would remember him no doubt as the boy, their sister's fiancé, who had sent them the American shoes. He knew her address by heart, of course. He'd written it out two or three times a year every year since Eva passed away, sending them a card at Christmas and always a line or two in late September, brief notes that said he was thinking of them, remembering Eva, giving Mary his best regards. Never more than a line or two, so he would never be forced to say that he had married, bought a house, carried on. Never really expecting a reply from the old folks, and only briefly hurt that Mary hadn't been in touch with him. But Dennis was tied up with that part of it, he knew, her feelings for him, because even though she went straight home when Eva died, she could not have expected another girl, Claire Donovan, to take up Dennis's affections so soon. She could not have helped but feel jilted. Driving the narrow, wrong-sided roads between Dublin and Clonmel, parched, shaky, chilled to the bone by the dampness and the cold, although the car's tiny heater was turned up full blast, he knew he would have to go to her family first, and at some point tell them that he had a wife at home, a house, despite the number of times over the years he had written them to say,